Blog Talk Radio.
Carolina, and I'm the head football coach at Marion High School, and I want to thank all of you for showing up tonight. Look like we got some people on board already. I don't know how many on the internet, but I want to thank you for joining us on the first broadcast of the Triple Wing Hammer Report, where we will be talking about all facets of the wing game. I believe that any offense with a wing is dangerous. I mean, you have to just adjust for that dude, and you got to find him. I mean, he can run, he can block, and he can go off of passes. You know, versus where you put him out on the outside or line him up outside. You know, in our defense, we just lock down on man for man. But once he's in that wing, you know, it causes problems. You know, I'm just ecstatic to be doing this. This is our first broadcast, and I hope it would be a service to you, because you know, a lot has been given to me and our success that we've had with the wing game, and I just want to give something back and try to get some things going here for everybody. A couple of announcements, but before I get to those announcements, we got some great guests coming on in the future. We got a whole list of them. People such as Hugh White, Corey Parker, Harold Sprouse from California, and Steve Galante. And these guys have graciously agreed to come on and share their philosophies and what they do. And this is not about trying to get you to change to do what you're doing, but trying to enhance in what you were doing, because I remember our last state championship game we played in when I was at Scotch Branch. This team that we played them 3 years in a row for the state championships, and we were split. And this last team they had, we had no business on the field with them. And I knew we had to do something. I'm double wing base, and I knew we had to do something differently. But because we practice single wing stuff every day, that we were able to go and do some things in the single wing. As a matter of fact, we did the old Notre Dame box where we did the triple spin, and that really knocked them off the loop, whereas we were able to go and run our double wing stuff, and we eventually ended up winning that ball game. But if we had not done that, I thought, you know, it was my thought that we would, you know, get blown out of the stadium, because they had many more athletes than we did on the field. A couple of announcements before we get going here. And with our guest, Dr. Ward, Coming up, and I'll be making an announcement. So if you guys got things that you want to that you want me to announce over this network, just email me, and I'll, you know, you got some kids who are doing some great things. You got a new job or whatever. Just email me, and I'll be glad to let the whole world know who's listening to the Triple Wing World. But the big one, we have our National Single Wing Coach Association meeting in June in Dumfries, Virginia. That's June 26th through 28th. And Dumfries, Virginia is 30 miles from south of Washington, D.C. And I think John Paul, the great high school, Jerry Sargent, who is the head coach, that is hosting this year. And they have lined up some great speakers for that symposium. And people such as Travis Connors from North Carolina, he'll be talking about using the multiple formation to attack defenses and the quick kick as a weapon. Derek Miner, who will be talking about the Princeton single wing system. Mickey Thompson, who will be talking about his Stonebridge system, and I from understand he's done a great job with the single wing there. Sean O will be talking about the T-Series. Corey Parker from Michigan, he'll be talking about the Dutch Oven, which is Dutch Meyer short punt in the Riverview system. And, you know, one thing I say, you need to be out here to see these guys and to meet these guys, because these guys will give you the share of the back in order for you to be good. I know when I first experienced this thing about 10 years ago, I was amazed at how people would help you and the help that you would get and everything. So if you get a chance to go there, you know, if you have nothing to do during the summer, you know, and you've got a family vacation plan, I would go to Washington, D.C. and sit in on these people, because there's so a lot to see. And plus, you got they got legends. I know they got the two legends. They're Ed Risley from Maine and George Rakovich from Colorado. And you would get all this knowledge and stuff. And if you can, I would ask you to go. I mean, you can't lose. And the cost is good. I mean, it only costs $25 for the clinic fee and for an individual coach. But if you bring your whole staff, it's $50 if you bring your whole staff. So put that on your calendar, and I'll be announcing this every week so we can go from there. We got the ward here. And, you know, you can – I don't know if you know anything about John Ward, but you saw some things up on went to our site here with the radio station, you saw his biography there. But that doesn't tell not even 10% who John Ward is. And I'm not talking about the X's and O's. This is a great man, and he's one of my traveling buddies when we go to the clinics. Him and another guy called Jordy Higgins out of South Carolina, we always travel together when we go to these clinics, and I don't know why, we just get in, we talk, and I got to learn these two guys, and they're just like brothers to me. But Dr. Ward is from North Carolina. He's currently at Warren County High School, and as soon as I can get him online, we are going to go ahead and get started with Dr. Ward and see what kind of knowledge he can get us to us, and see if we can learn anything tonight. Now, if you want to ask a question and you're online, you dial 646-652-2659. Let me say that again, 646-652-2659. If you're online and if you want to ask a question, raise your hand and press the number 1 on your phone, and it will let me know that you want to ask a question, and I'll click on you. But let me see if I can get Dr. Ward on right now, and see if we can get going here.
I'm here.
Are you there?
I am.
Good Lord, have mercy. Hey, I hope I didn't mess that up, John.
No, I got in like 1 minute, Coach. I was in 1 minute before you, well, 21 seconds before your show actually started, and I went ahead and pressed the 1, and I didn't realize that you wouldn't know what the cue was. I'm calling from my home number instead of my cell. That might be why you didn't recognize
okay.
it.
Oh, I know. You're the only one I know in 850 area code. But I got you covered and everything. But let me tell you, I am so happy to have you on the show. You know, when I first came up with Desire Day, I said you would have to be the first one because we go back long ways. You know, when I first started getting involved in the wing game, and I was going through the internet and everything, your name kept popping up and kept popping up. And I think the first time I met you was in South Carolina, if I'm not mistaken, either South Carolina or Missouri. I can't remember which one.
Carolina.
I'm sorry, John?
I think we did meet at Coastal Carolina for the first time.
Yeah, I can't remember which one, but we have been like peas in a pod ever since. And I just want to get us started right here and get you going. And could you, first of all, you know, I'm not so much interested in the X's and O's right now, but a lot of people know of Dr. Ward. You know, you see this fiery guy speaking at the thing. But could you let people know a little bit who you are and what you're all about, your philosophy and everything?
Well, the single wing and I go back, way back, not so much the single wing that I run today, but, you know, I actually played in a single wing offense in high school, little tiny school. It was a little 2A school in Western North Carolina, Cranberry High School. It was in Avery County. Now they've got all three of the schools that were there up until my senior year have consolidated, and it's Avery County High School. And off and on, they've been fairly successful. I guess our school is very fortunate. 44-year history of the school, there was never a losing season. And when we ran single wing for more than half of that through a lot of different coaches. I happened to play for a guy that never donned a football uniform, and he was extremely successful. But I started out in football there as far as high school football. I played a little bit of peewee football and youth football before that, two or three years. And we didn't have all the leagues that we have today for youth. And when I went off to college to play at Appalachian State, and we were running the I formation, I didn't think that was real football. I went there as a defensive player, but it took a little while to be convinced that other stuff was real football. Now, obviously, in the I formation, if you've got the right combination of fullback, tailback, and some guards or tackles, you can make it be devastating, but I just thought it was a lot easier to play against and what I'd done for 4 years in a row against our single wing. And Mars Hill High School was running single wing in those days, and everybody would tinker with it some because most of the offenses on that day, as well as today, most of those offenses were in some way related back to the single wing offense.
Okay. And where have you been? I know you're at Warren County High School right now, but what have you, kind of fill in the space in between there. I think when I first met you, you were at Port St. Lucie, and I remember I got some tapes. What's your assistant coach name, Doug? Doug, what's Doug's last name?
Doug Kerr, K-E-R-R. He's the head coach at Iowa. And in fact, he later became the head coach at Port St. Lucie. And did a very good job there. Doug was an outstanding assistant. I was fortunate enough for Doug to play for us at Lindenwood College when I was coaching in college over about a 14-year period. I spent about four or five of those years at Lindenwood. It's in St. Charles, Missouri. It's one of the, suburbs off St. Louis. And Doug came out of a Derby High School out of Wichita, Kansas, right outside Wichita, and he played for us there, and I was lucky enough to get him to come down to Port St. Lucie during my third year down there as an assistant coach. He was my O-line coach, and then he eventually became a defense coordinator for me in Florida. We were together there at Hamilton County and at Bronson, and Doug did a great job. When I left Florida to come back to North Carolina, He became the head coach at Bronson, and then from there he went out and worked with Mark Bliss. Mark got the job in South Florida, and he was with him 1 year, and then he became the head coach at Port St. Lucie, and I guess the rest is history. He's now a head coach at Iola, Kansas.
Yeah, and he sent me those tapes, and the first time I actually had a chance to sit down and actually study the single wing, And I saw this wedge, and man, I just looked at that wedge and I said, I got to have some of this. I mean, and we became and when I was at Scotch Branch, we became famous for that wedge play. But that is a devastating play. And where were you? You were at Port St. Lucie, and you did some time at West Harnett High School, I believe.
At Harnett Central. Western Harnett is where my buddy and your buddy Travis Connor was before I went to Harnett Central. While I was at Port St. Lucie, Travis was the head coach at Western Harnett, and he was
uh-huh.
having quite a famous time up here with the Notre Dame box. In fact, he's the guy that got on ESPN television with Western Harnett, and I came to Harnett Central as he left and went to Georgia as a head coach.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So that's our path off. And now you then you went to another school in North Carolina, I believe, right? I can't think of the name of it right now.
Yes, I went from Harnett Central to Union High School in Sampson County, just south of Clinton, Clinton, North Carolina. I know you're familiar with Clinton, South Carolina, but we were there at Clinton, at Union High School for 4 years. Two of those years we went to the semifinals of the state championship, where we were trying to put together and couldn't quite duplicate the success you had at Scotts Branch, but we had some pretty fair football teams there.
Oh, you had some great football teams there, John. I was always fascinated how you always put that stuff together. What is your basic philosophy of football?
Well, my philosophy, as it has been yours, it seems that my calling has been to go into programs that have not been very successful. When I say that, that's probably a vast understatement. All the programs that I've become the head coach at have spent at least 4, 5, or 6 years, some of them more than that, in one win or zero wins, or at the most 2 wins a year. So my philosophy has developed over the years into a slightly different philosophy than I started out with. My philosophy is this, that the way you turn programs around is you got to play very good defense. Notwithstanding that we haven't quite got that far here yet at Warren County, that you can, if you play good defense, and if you can run the football and you're mistake-free in the special teams part of the game, I think you're going to be very, very successful. Now, I don't know that you're going to win a state championship every year, but I do think that whoever gets to the state championship from your conference, your district, or your region, if you do those three things, they're going to have to go through you to get there. And, we've had years where we couldn't throw the football hardly at all, and we're very successful and went 3 and 4 rounds deep in the playoffs. And then the years that we've been able to run the football and pass it, it's been a whole lot easier trek to that idea. I'm not opposed to throwing the football. If anyone ever sees my playbook, they're always surprised because there's actually more passes in my playbook than there are runs. Now, that doesn't reflect one's philosophy. It's just that part of my philosophy is this. If you have a run play, any run play you have, any run action you have, you should have a pass off of that run action. And, in fact, that's what we emphasize in our part of the passing game, the play-action passing, which, of course, includes the boots. And you mentioned the wing a while ago, whether you're talking about single wing, double wing, or any kind of wing offense, and how that wing back can be a runner, a receiver, or a great blocker in our offense. And I know you've seen it. He throws the football as well. All three of my four backs throw balls out of it. I've worked on trying to come up with a way the blocking back that other people call him blocking back, I call him the fullback. We've worked on trying to come up with a pass for him. Obviously, our quarterback and tailback have been throwing. Our wingback throws one pass and one pass only. It's just amazing to me. At Port St. Lucie, those films you saw, that year my wingback had 9 or 10 touchdown passes. I think it was 10, and I think the quarterback only had 9. This year, my wingback had 8 touchdown passes and something like 16 completions, and they all came off of one play. Off of, while he can run the ball on his sweep, off tackle, or the trap inside, when the defense sees it start to develop, they don't know which of those three it's going to be. And so the same action that he runs any one of those three, he can throw the football, and it's a play-action pass with the tight end, my fullback, or the other guys calling the blocking back route and the pass route. And knock on wood, we've been, you know, about half the years we've been extremely successful with him throwing the ball too.
Okay. So many, and I totally agree with you with the wing thing. When I look at it from the defensive part of the ball, it's just that wing always gave us pause. It always make us work a little bit harder because we, you know, we just don't know what he is going to do. What are you doing in off season? What do you do during your off season to try to get your players ready for the upcoming season?
Well, some of that is dictated, of course, by state and local regulations and everything. And here we're doing quite differently than we did other places. It's a battle here where I'm at in Warren County. We're trying to make sure we're getting kids to the weight room as much as we can. But, however, the problem is in a smaller situation like this, obviously, during the winter, most of your football players are involved in other sports. And in the spring, the same thing is true. Right now, I would say 80% of my football team is either in track, baseball, golf, or tennis. So, you know, I've got about 20% of them in the weight room after school, and we've got to solve an issue here about getting the weight room like most schools are doing today and having at least one block or one period during the day devoted to athletes in the weight room, especially football players. And we've been able to get that solved in other places. We still are yet to do that here, and I've been told we're going to get that done. I thought we would have it done by this year, but we haven't. So what we do primarily here is we spend a lot of time in the weight room. Now, the state provides for us to get outside some with the restriction on numbers. In North Carolina, you can't exceed a total of 21 at any time for any kind of ball skills workout and everything. You can do training, you can do lifting, and you can do running activities, purely just running. If a football appears, 21 is the max you can have. And in North Carolina, we do not have spring football per se, like, let's say, I did in Florida, where I had a completely different philosophy about the off season than I do here, and I'll talk about that in a minute, if you will. But here, it's a big battle just to try to get my kids, in the weight room. About 80% of my kids at Warren County, we're still playing with what would have won a lot of football games for you in the 60s and early 70s when everybody wasn't lifting weights year-round. But in the new millennium, especially in the second decade of the new millennium, what we're doing is not that great since everybody else in our district is ahead of us in that department. We're doing that in the middle of May when track and baseball are over with. Then we will, they're going 3 days a week after school lifting, those that aren't in the other sports. And then starting in the middle of May, we'll go 4 days a week, and we'll spend two of those days both weight room and outside doing some skills work. We'll spend one other day only weight room or speed development, and then the fourth day will be only outside and not in the weight room at all. And we will work on very basic things, footwork for backs in the spin game, footwork and timing for those guys. We'll do some passing. Our linemen will work on their footwork for drills. A lot of great drills can be done. We're restricted again in North Carolina. You can't put on you can put on a helmet. You can put on pads and things, but you can't go body to body, and you can't hit sleds. You can't even hit dummies. So it's great for acclimating to those pads, but I don't think you need to acclimate to the pads so much in May as you do in the end of June, 1st of July, to get ready for August. Now, when I was at Port St. Lucie, at Bronson or Hamilton County, heck, we had spring football. you know, Florida high school football, they have more spring football days than the NCAA allows, or the NAIA, or any of those college divisions do. You have 30 days to get 20 days of practice in Florida. If you want to play a jamboree or a spring exhibition game, you can, but that counts as one of the 20 days. Now, I never got in 20 days ever. I think one year at Port St. Lucie, my first year there, we got in 18 days, I think, 18 or 19 days. But now that's a different set of facts altogether. Again, lots of guys are out for baseball. They're out for track. You got a few that will be in golf and tennis, but that's not a bad thing. That allows kids that you may not be looking at in a spring football situation if those kids weren't involved in those other activities. That allows you a great chance to look at them. And it never bothered me that a baseball kid only got in 10, if we were very successful in baseball, maybe 8 to 14 days of spring ball, somewhere in that range. Mm-hmm. And the same thing is true of the track team. So that never bothered me. But the great thing is with spring football and you're putting on pads and everything, you can get a lot. You can get ready for the summer. I think the one thing you have to avoid, I think Rick Darlington does a great job with that at Apopka, is not burning your kids out when you get to that point. I think that Rick's philosophy is he gives them 1 month where the football part is off. I think that's what he does, 3 weeks or 1 month, because he's got them 12 months a year, and he gives them 3 weeks to either a month. The only thing he has them do is the weight room, no football stuff, because, you know, in Florida, football's pretty important, and the bad thing is, you know, you being the football coach and your assistants as well, you can burn them out 12 months a year.
I agree with you 100%. We never pick up a football until spring practice because if we have spring practice, because, you know, it's the burnout factor. You know, and when the guys ask me why I do that, well, we are planning for a 16-week season. You know, our goal is always to be playing the last game of the year. And, you know, you got to be very careful how you manage that because kids can hit that bottom or hit the top of that thing and they're just dead and can't give me anymore. Let me ask you one other thing, which is important because a lot of coaches get, you know, they get frustrated and everything because of that they can't get the kids and everything. But I think they got to understand that the smaller schools have to do different things. How's your staff working out?
We're getting better every day. We've still got a ways to go and everything, but we're getting better. The staff situation here has gotten better every single week that I've been here. We still do have some things that we've got to shore up, and all that responsibility lies with me. I'm the guy that's got to get that straightened out. We are getting better every single day, though. You know, when I came here, it was a very inexperienced, at the level of high school football, an inexperienced staff. We've come very close to getting a couple very experienced coaches in here, and for whatever reason, weren't able to get them those teaching positions. So we're using, with the exception of one guy that I got hired last year, we're using paraprofessionals in every slot except for the one guy that we hired last year and one other guy who works in a staff position, not a teaching position, but a staff position in the school system. And all of those guys, though, have gotten better as coaches, and they spend a lot of time getting better. I think they've done a great job.
So that's great. I know when we talked earlier, that was a concern of yours and everything, which is a concern to me too. But I'm glad that's getting better for you. Now, let's talk about the single wing thing. Now, a lot of people don't realize that there are many kinds of different single wings out there. You know, people do different things.
Think I said to you before, I played in a single wing, and I played in a genre that is a lot of fun, I think. As a coach, I just didn't know it. It just goes to prove to you, you know, everybody thinks that, you know, I called our plays on offense when I was in high school, although my coach decided that, you know, the older football, the older single wing football coaches didn't necessarily think the quarterback was the leader by himself. And I actually, as a center, called our plays on offense and then turned right around on defense as the middle linebacker and called our defense. And when I say I called them, I don't mean the coach sent me in plays. I meant during the week I had to learn what the game plan was, and I had to call those plays playing center. And it goes to show you what I was going to say. I say all that to say this. Even though we were playing in this offense, today I tinker with this offense, whereas Stephen Ragsdale and others have made a heck of a living at it and won a few state titles, not more than a few state titles. And that is the Buck Lateral series. That's what my team played in high school. We played Buck Lateral, and, of course, what most people have, the direct power, which, you know, your clubs have been outstanding at running. I think your Hammer and my 56 are kind of icons of what we do. But I just don't feel like I'm a great, you know, being a player in an offense doesn't qualify you to be a coach. So when I got started back with this thing full force, when I first got to Port St. Lucie, and there's a great coach in New Mexico who you have met, Ted Hearn, who was so gracious to send me film and talk to me over the phone hours and hours and hours. But the reason I decided on what I do, our base series other than the straight power, it was based on seeing a film of him. And while he didn't run, and I know of no one that has had that wedge play in before I did a long time ago in the 70s and forward, while he didn't have that play in, I'd never seen someone run the full spin series. And, wow, I was mesmerized. I couldn't find the football on the screen. You know, if there's one thing they told me I was pretty good about in college and everywhere is that I see things fast in film. I might not see everything fast, but I see those things. Movement, I'm pretty good at the analysis of movement, let alone the motions that come in a game. And I was totally mesmerized. So I just I harangued him, I guess, into giving me, he went in the gym and had guys help him film some stuff for me. And I decided right then and there at Port St. Lucie, the full spin series was the greatest, the most complete football series I'd ever seen in football. And that was going to be part of what I did. And the years we've been very successful, it is an integral part of what we do now. We also do something that everybody says I invented, which I did not. You almost invent nothing in this game. But I took an old half spin that Glenn Snyder out at Kansas State demonstrated one year at Liberty, William Jewell College in Liberty, Missouri. He did the half spin, and that was on the tail end of when Joe Gibbs was killing everybody with his counter tray. So I took the counter tray blocking and put it with a half spin. But that's very successful, in my opinion, because we make the full spin such an important part we do. But all right, I've mentioned three offenses: half spin, full spin, buck lateral. You can be a T-series guy. It's a great weak side attack. People like George Rakovich and Mark Bliss have won many state titles running those things, and let alone how many football games they've ran running the T-series. You can be short punt. You know, it's the NFL's first run at the so-called shotgun was really nothing but the short punt offense. Again, you mentioned Dutch Myers earlier, the coach that's going to present this summer at our national symposium, Corey Parker, using a part of that Dutch Myers series. And if anybody's not ever seen that movie, they certainly need to see that movie. About the 12 orphans that Dutch started out with and then moved on to coach in college and at the university level, and of course is in many Hall of Fames, college and high school. But there's so many genres. The triple spin, which you mess around with some, it's just, there's probably at least 10 genres of single wing football that are noted genres, and there's probably more.
John, you still there?
Yes, I am. I'm still here.
Oh, okay, yeah, okay. Okay, I went dead there for a second, okay. Yeah.
I can identify right off at least 10 of them.
Yeah, there's a bunch of them. What is the most important thing? There's a big plate out here, all these brands of single wings and everything. What's the most important thing that you can get to a coach who wants to dabble, who wants to get into the single wing thing? What's the most important advice you could give him?
here's the most important advice I can give you, and it's just not apropos. This is my opinion, of course, and as I tell everybody on here, this is not the Bible. It's just the gospel according to John. Every offense boils down to how you block. Your blocking scheme, whatever you want to call it, we call it our blocking rules. And I think that what you've got to do to be extremely successful is not only the KISS method, keeping it simple, but keep it simple across. You know, most everybody is going to have more than one series they depend on in football, whether you're an I-formation team or you're a spread, you know, a la the spread that everybody's running today, zone reads or whatever you want to call it. You've got to come up with blocking rules that are, I think, three things. One is they are simple and they are flexible so that you can go from your full spin series to the half spin or full spin to the power, and you're not changing a lot of things for the big uglies up front. I think those two things are vital to being successful up there. I think there's a lot of people who spend a lot of time on what is a newfangled thing that perhaps is appropriate for professional level athletes or even college level athletes that may not be so apropos to the high school, middle school, or even youth level. And I guess one of the things, many of the backs that I send off to college, up until the last year, I probably sent about, in the last 10 years, at least six tailbacks that have been over 1,500 yards, five of them over 2,000 yards, one or more years in our offense, and they all have been, you know, to some degree successful at the next level. And one of the first things they come back and tell me, Coach, I wish that you could go convince some of these college coaches the blocking schemes that you've taught us, because it's so much easier to find the holes in the defense by identifying where certain blockers are, like you teach it, because as the zone scheme goes, and I know there are people that are very successful with that, but you've got to read. You're talking about young guys today, and those college stars are younger and younger every day, younger and younger. The one and done is a big deal. You know, everybody's talking about today that, you know, in college, in football, it's almost one and done now. But the crazy thing is when you go to the zone blocking rules, that back, it's a lot more ambiguity or vagueness to where he's going to go. And at least it's been the experience of my backs to come back and say, if I didn't have some talent, Coach, I don't know whether I'd gain yardage on every play. So I think what high school coaches, what middle school coaches, and youth league coaches do, as we all did at one point in our life, if still don't, we get mesmerized by what we see on Sundays and Saturdays and think, that's what I need to be doing. What you really need to be doing is to learn some system, learn it inside and out. Your knowledge, nothing can replace your knowledge. And hopefully you're learning something that you truly believe in, and then you become the expert on your field. You don't have to be the expert at my field. You have to be the expert on your field in employing those blocking techniques. Because once the ball gets snapped, this is my opinion again, once the ball is snapped, everybody's offense boils down to what your blocking is. That's what I believe.
And the blocking scheme you use is basically SAB, right?
Yeah, that's our basis for everything. We have the severe angle blocking, and, you know, I called it a gap scheme for a long time, and it's gotten refined a little more and a little more each year. And I'll be honest with you, a youth league coach is the one that had as big an impact as anybody did. I mean, I think you saw the same presentation I did out at, you know, we had the symposium out at William Jewell College several years, but I know you came at least to two of them, and I went to three or four of them out there, and a young man by the name of Eric Strutz with the State Line Comets out in the Midwest, he presented on severe angle blocking, and he did, you know, my wife says all the time, you disguise yourself as a jock, but you're really a nerd or a geek, because this guy presented all the physics of the blocking. He presented all the laws of physics. He presented all this, you know, the work formulas, et cetera, for using a 30-degree step and how much force it would take 180-pound guy to move a 230-pound guy at a 30-degree angle and so on and so forth. And I was just taken aback that here's a youth guy that's using science behind what he's doing, and then I watched his kids, and I thought, how simple is that? And I, you know, if he can do that at that level, there's got to be a way to do it. And I'd already believed in the down block and the kick out and hopefully coming up with double teams as you were doing it. And, I've kind of at least polished or brushed it to what I, you know, how we handle minute or minutiae, if you will, in our offense. But, yeah, the severe angle blocking is the basis of what we do. It's actually the basis of everything we do, whatever we're doing, whether we're running a trap or sweeps or obviously what I prefer to do is that you also prefer to do, and that's to bring it off tackle.
Well, I know it saved us. That's the only blocking scheme we teach. Because, you know, we can do it. What I found out, you can do all of your plays just from that one blocking scheme. And the other thing it does, it gives you line continuity, and those guys don't have to think about what they're doing. They just go out there and do it. They know, all right, which direction you're running, let's go. And they just come in, they just do one hell of a job doing it.
I agree with you 100%. My conceptual approach to that was I saw Eric do that. I thought, you know, everybody thinks you're a genius with this wedge play. What is the wedge except for actually bringing angles on both sides down? And I said, no, really, all you're doing is wedge blocking on one half the line, and the other half you're bringing somebody to kick out, run the funnel, or whatever.
It's amazing how simple things can crush you.
That's correct.
Now you say that you don't pass much. Is it because you, like me, who never had a quarterback that can throw the ball, or is it just that you just never met your fancy? Because I've seen some of your tapes of guys who can throw the ball, and they barely get the ball there, but the ball gets there.
That's correct, and I think they barely get the ball there, and it gets there because people have to sell out eventually. We're so committed to the run that people have to definitely sell out to stop the run. And if we have somebody who can halfway throw the football, we're very successful. Now, I had a young man at Union High School who played 2 years in a row for me at the quarterback position. And by the second year, he was a better-than-average passer. And he threw the ball for – he alone, the quarterback, threw for about 1,200 yards that year. And when you're in my offense and we were rushing just under 5,000 yards that year, you had 1,200 yards of passing by the quarterback, and then another 500 or 600 by our wingback, and another 200 by our tailback, and you're throwing the ball really good that year. Of course, again, we run the ball for, you know, we had a 2,600 yard rusher, and I had another, you know, the two fullbacks combined were 1,100 and some yards, or what most people call a blocking back. Our quarterback, the two quarterbacks we used, the thrower, he rushed for about 350 yards, and the other guy rushed for about 500. It's not that I don't want to throw the football. This year, people were really amazed when unfortunately, I really miss you, but you didn't get up to the conclave this year. And there was one guy, believe it or not, Leonard, I know you can't believe this was said to Coach Ward, but a guy said, you must throw the ball a lot. And everybody started dying laughing. And then they saw my film, and they were amazed at, you know, how many times my wingback, who was, by the way, my backup quarterback, to try to create, as you do, all my guys have to learn at least two positions. We cross-train them at least two. I know guys that are better than me and cross-train them at every single position you have, but I cross-train mine, you must learn two positions, so we have some depth. And it just so happened that my second-best quarterback and some nights my best quarterback was, in fact, the starting wingback about seven of our, or eight of our games this year. So, he's a left-handed kid, which I prefer to have the left-handed quarterback because there's so many play-action things we have the quarterback do to the left. Now, I will tell you this. That year at Union, when Dusty Weeks threw for nearly 1,200 yards, he was a right-handed kid, but he threw most, I'll guarantee you, out of 1,100 and some yards, he had 780 to 800 yards of that on one play, 75 boot, which means he's booting to his left, and he's right-handed. And he just, he tore defenses up with it. Now, I will tell you this, we could run that half spin pretty doggone good that year, both to the left and to the right. So it worked out very well for us. It's not so much that I don't want to throw the football. It goes back to my philosophy, though. If you can run the football, it gets a lot easier to throw it. And you said a mouthful when you said, I haven't been blessed necessarily, and I think this is part of what a small school's about. A lot of times you don't find prototypical passer slash quarterbacks more than you do a lot of running back types. I think that's a fair statement. I'm not saying you can't find a passer in a small school. You can, and you certainly can develop them. If you want to spend all your time developing one kid, you know, guys will talk to me all the time. That's what you need to do is develop us a passer. I'll get administrators sometimes who like to dive into coaching or think they know what you. You know, you're working with one kid. I'd rather be working with 10 kids than one kid. You know what I'm saying. I know I'm talking to the choir right here. Actually, I'm not talking to the choir. I'm talking to the brethren. But, it's a matter of, do I want to work with one kid a lot about throwing this football, or would I rather work a lot with a lot of guys in what we can do and make it a team concept, not only the backs, all of them, the three or four positions you got there, but making those linemen feel extremely important. And you'll never convince me that linemen, offensive linemen, feel a whole lot more important in run offenses than they do pass offenses. Truly good offensive linemen are always wanting you to run the football because they know they get a chance to shine there. The only offensive linemen that I've ever met who wanted to throw the football mostly were offensive linemen that I would not have said were among the better linemen I have. And that is without exception. And that is at every level, high school and college.
Mm-hmm. Now, I need to ask you this question right here, John, because this actually was very important to me when in my development of the wings, as I call it, but actually the single and the double wing. How important is it for guys to go to the conclaves and symposium?
I think it's extremely important. There's a number of reasons. Number one reason, though, is the network. You know, I don't know if I've taught anybody anything about this offense or anything. I know this. My wife laughs all fall, and she goes, you know, you stay up till 2 or 3 o'clock every morning trying to get your stuff ready. Then you got to get up at 5:30 right after that and get to school. And you're an idiot because you spend every evening, three nights a week, you're on the phone. Either, you know, most of the time somebody's calling you or you're calling to bounce an idea off of somebody else. And that's why I think they need to do it. They need to make connections so that they become, as I said earlier, I think you need to be the expert on your field. And the way you do that is not just listen to John Ward or to Leonard Johnson, but to bounce it through a lot of guys. And, you know, if you start hearing or seeing the same thing said or done several times in a row, you start to go, you know, there must be something to this. This must be it. So I think networking is number one. Obviously, just learning something new or learning a new way to skin a cat, if you will. You know, I used to snap like everybody else, try to spiral snap. And it was a youth coach. I didn't know that Jock Sutherland, umpteen years ago at Pitt, taught the dead snap or the end-over-end snap or whatever you want to call it. I just call it the dead snap the same way that I remember teaching backs how to toss, you know, quarterbacks how to toss a sweep to a tailback. If for want of a better word, you stop. Nobody's trying to spiral that thing out there on that toss. You're trying to throw it as dead to him as you can because it makes it softer, bigger, easier to catch. And after all, spiraling the ball is a lot like shooting a pistol or a rifle. Well, you know, we don't have a bore to true the flight of that ball, and it can get caught on rough grass and all those kind of things. Well, so what I'm trying to say, I say that to say this. You just don't know how many things you can walk away with from a conclave or a symposium, or you know, I'm getting ready here in the next year or so, if we hadn't had so many medical issues in my family over the last year or two, I'd plan to do it this year. But we're going to have some stuff here in the Carolinas that certainly more than the Carolinas are going to be invited to, people from Virginia and South and North Carolina, anywhere you want to come from. But just to get with one other staff, it's so great to do that. And sometimes you come away, if you come away with one great thing, one year I came away from the conclave with that SNAP. And it solved more bad SNAPs for me than anything did. One year I got that SAB idea from a youth guy, by the way, both of these. Now, I didn't know that they had, you know, some college guy had been doing that SNAP forever, but I heard a youth guy doing the SAB presentation. And that youth guy didn't have nearly as many years of experience as John Ward did at that point. But you can learn from, you get, sometimes we have to let the student teach us, the player, in other words. But the number one reason that guys need to get to these things, in my opinion, is the networking. Number two, that leads to knowledge. And as I said earlier, I think nothing trumps knowledge. I teach a class in ACT and SAT prep, and I try to teach them all, and I coach them on how to score when they do and they don't know the answers. But the first thing I try to teach them is nothing trumps knowledge. If you know the answer, you know the answer. And you give yourself a lot better chances to know the answer the more of these things you get out to. A lot of the guys that are going to listen to you are teachers and coaches. And I assure you, in their discipline, they certainly need to and have to keep up with what is going on in the discipline. And the same thing is true of football coaches.
Well, I'm a big fan on conclaves and symposium. This is how I learned. I met some of the great ones. I'm talking about the Steve Ragsdale, the Ted Hearns, and those guys. And just actually sit down and ask them questions, and they give you an answer back that you understand. And again, not to hold your thumb down because you hold your nose down to a guy because he's a youth coach. Those youth coaches will teach you more about what's going on because they are grounded. They know what's going on and everything. But I think if people start looking at the conclaves and the symposium as expenditures and start looking at them as investment, and I don't know if you agree with them, I think a lot more will start going to these things. What do you think?
I do, but I'll tell you what, if you want to look at it as expenditure, I don't mind if you want to do some comparative shopping. If I'm going to buy a shirt and I see the same shirt for sale in store A and store X, and store X has that exact same shirt for 10% less, guess which one I'm going to buy? And it's more than 10% difference in going to a symposium and a conclave for what you get and what is shared with you. You go to Nike or Coach of the Year ones, and if there's a guy that runs single-wing offense that's speaking with you, there's one guy there going to share ideas with you, one guy, and it'll be worth your time. But if you go to the symposium or conclave, you're going to hear how many ever speakers there are that share the same ideas about single wing in philosophical terms and in acceptance, acceptance, because let's just face it, you know, it's like Urban Meyer said to me one year down in Florida. I said, come on, when you've used Tebow, you're really just using single wing. And I heard him say it a different way than that before that at a bowl game. He was announcing at a bowl game one of the years he didn't win the national championship, and one guy was haranguing the team that was on the field about receiving a direct snap. I believe it was Auburn. Receiving a direct snap inside the 10-yard line. That's a dumb idea, taking the ball off the line of scrimmage. And Urban Meyer said something that was very smart. And I've heard a couple other guys, not very many of them, but he said, you know, there is spread football, and then there's direct snap the way they're doing it. The way they're doing it, you're going to get the line as fast or faster than you do handing it off. And the thing is that Urban Meyer said to me that when I said, look, when you've got 10 people running your offense, it's more single wing than it is today's avant-garde spread. And he said, you know that and I know that, but John, I can't say that. These guys would pair us up and I'd never get recruits to come and play. So my point to these guys is, when you go to these Coach of the Year things. And when I went to when I was in Florida, and the only high school in Florida running single wing, the only one, when it would be mentioned at a clinic, at our state clinic or anywhere, and the people that knew that I was doing that, they'd all turn around and they would be amazed. They'd look at me and everything, but it was kind of this half-hearted sneer or laughter about, man, that guy's got a lot of guts. Or when I talk to opponents, they'd say, Coach, why don't you change offenses? They'd just get through telling me how bad it was all week to prepare for us, and then ask me right behind that, why don't you change? And I said, you just told me why I'm not going to change. But if you go to a symposium or a conclave, you're not going to face people who are going to question you running the single wing. It's just the opposite. They're going to support you. And while they might not be running the genre that you're interested in, they will be glad to point you towards someone who does, or towards some literature or some other direction that gets you to there. And they won't be saying, you know, that can't be done.
Okay. Well, I'm glad you said that, because you know, a lot of the young guys don't want to invest in their craft, and I think you got to invest. You know, you will get the return if you work at it.
How much does it cost to go to a Nike Coach of the Year, or I'm trying to think of the other one, the big prominent one besides the Coach of the Year? What is the other one? The it's on the tip of my tongue. The other one that's so big and nationally. How much does it cost to go to those?
Talking about Glazier and those guys.
Glazier and Coach and Nike, and what's it cost to go to those?
About $75 to $80 a pop.
And that's just the clinic fee. When you go to Iowa, symposium, and you go to the conclave,
$75.
If you get a shirt and that. And you could probably pay for one of your lunches at the conclave inside of $75.
I tell you what, it's you get a lot of bang for your buck. I can attest to that. I remember the first time I went to Missouri, and this is where I learned one little concept I learned from Jim Ahern, and that was his red zone concept. That changed the entire blocking scheme right there. I got it. It hit me right then, you know. And from that, our offensive lines were solid. You know, we didn't make many mistakes because we understood that red zone concept.
Well, that's where I started from in what I call the gap scheme at that time there. And I stole that same idea from Jim Ahern, one of the greats. You're talking about a guy that runs single wing spread, if you will. And it's what led to, you know, 2 years down the road, me saying, well, what's a better idea of the red zone than to bring those guys at 30-degree angles and use, you know, not let those defensive guys take an inside route on you. I'm not going to say it how Corey Parker does, but I'm going to say not letting them get inside on that route.
Mm-hmm. One last question, John, before we shut it down for tonight. You know, everybody is going no huddle, up tempo, and all this stuff because of the Auburns and the Oregons, the Oklahomas, and the Texas A&M, and some high school teams that are doing this stuff. How does that fit into what we do? The up tempo, is it a hindrance? Is it a help? Explain your concept when it comes to that.
I think there are people that it's a headdress for. I think there are people that are going to dive in and do it and not know what they're doing. It goes back to not what you know. I want to say this, you know, please understand, I love it. And, you know, I guess to explain why, you know, explain my entire thing about this, my college roommate called me. We call and we talk almost at least four times a week during football, five or six times during football season. He no longer gets to coach. But I remember him saying, like, 3 years ago when everybody was – when Bellotti was starting to make it such a big deal at the University of Oregon and everybody was saying that, he said, let me get this straight now. He said, I remember coming to see a John Ward coach football team, and you were using flashcards on the sideline in Florida in the 90s. He said, and you were running no huddle in the 90s. He said, and all of a sudden, this is a brilliant idea. He said, you know, he said – everybody thinks you're old-fashioned and everything. And you were doing these flashcards a long time ago. Now, to answer your question, I think you have to have – I think the problem that people who go and jump in and do, you know, this speed-up offense and everything, need to understand that there's validity to speeding up and slowing down. And if you can do both, you're going to be better served than if you can do one. If you can do one, make sure you know how to do it. Make sure you got a stopwatch on them, and you're going to have to practice it. You can't just run plays in practice and not try to run the tempo you're creating for a game at practice, and you have to do it constantly. And I think you have to, if you want to use two or three different tempos, you better practice at least two or three different tempos at practice. And it's going to take more time than you think it is. Now, the first reason I've always told people that we do no huddle is so we get more plays in. And I do. Our teams average more plays than probably 85, if not 95% of teams do. But there have been years that no huddle, no hurry has been more important to me than no huddle, hurry up, or no huddle, you know, what I sometimes like to call warp speed. And you know, like I found out, you know, at Union, a half of 1 year, we were in warp speed probably 50% of the time. But those were kids that had ran it with me 2 and 3 years, and they were very good at it. And they understood when we were warp and when we went the other way. You know, sometimes young kids think warp is the only way to go because they've seen it on Saturday or Sunday again. You know, there's a guy now that moved from colleges to the pro ranks, and I think he's going to try to do it there. But to answer your question, if you're accomplished at it, if you know it inside and out, I certainly think it can be another weapon. Now, when those things become other weapons, there's a way that the football ethics and rules committees get involved sometimes and change that path and say, okay, this is going to be the boundaries from within which you must operate. You know, everybody was hot on this A11 offense 1 year, and 2 or 3 years later, the rules makers decided that they didn't want to do that because of officials. It was too difficult on them deciding who was an illegal receiver and who wasn't.
Okay, so you say you do it. How much of it in the game do you do it? Or what's your
percentages? We're no huddle 100% of the time, Coach Johnson. Now, we do the only huddle we ever have is on the sideline. We do, you know, my first year here in Warren County, we were probably no huddle, hurry up, maybe 8 or 10% of the time that year. We were no huddle, no hurry, probably 70% of the time. And then we were what I call NASCAR speed, which is a middle speed, if you will, about 20% of the time, okay? Last year, we had no huddle warp maybe 15 or 20% of the time, and we were no huddle, no hurry about 40 to 45% of the time, and maybe the NASCAR speed about 30 or 35% of the time. So as we get better, we get faster. But I do want to tell you this, just because you get good at running it, it doesn't, you still need to be a clock manager. And there's times I've won at least 10% of the games that I've won since I went to no huddle. Since the second year I went to no huddle, I've won at least 10, if not 15% of my wins have been over clock management and knowing when not to be in a hurry, when not to be in a hurry. If Blackjack taught us anything, the one thing he was intelligent about was what he said about clock management and ahead and behind and when you're supposed to be in a hurry, when you're not supposed to be in a hurry. It was a very well-written book about that. I'm not sure a single wing sells me, but his clock management book was a great book. It's very important. If the other team is more gifted and they're better in space than you are, then don't try to be in a hurry and get in space with them. If they are not as good as you are, obviously you can be in a faster pace. If you're ahead in the game, when you're ahead in the game, once you're ahead, the clock is what you need to stop. You've got enough to win at that point. And I think young guys all too often worry about how much I'm beating someone by. And at least to this point in high school football, style points aren't helping us. How much we beat people by doesn't matter. It's how we finish in our district or our conference, whether we get in the playoffs.
Okay. Now, last question, John. When you go to the ballpark on Friday nights, and what is your brand? What is that one thing people say that they got to stop, and what is that one thing you have to establish in that game? What is that one thing?
Well, I would guarantee you that you and I are identical about this. As I tell everybody, if we're going to be successful, we come off the bus running off tackle. And that's my one of two or three ways. Obviously, we would prefer to do it with what you call hammer or what I call 56 and 65. And that's just slamming it off tackle, direct snap, bum, 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 here we come. But there are a lot of ways to get the ball off tackle, and we can do that through the half spin or full spin. Off tackle is, you know, a long time ago, an older football coach, long before John Ward understood what real football talk and real football coaching was about, when I was a young coach, and I've said this, I guess people are tired of me saying it, but an older football coach said to me, young man, and I was an assistant, and I was his defense coordinator, he said, young man, if we're going to win in football, you're going to have to stop the off-tackle play, or we're not going to be successful. And he said, young man, if we're going to be successful on offense, we're going to have to be able to run off tackle. And I was too young then and dumb to understand it. So to this day, I think most coaches that go against me will tell you, when they come off the bus, you get ready because they're bringing it off tackle, either direction and both. And he's going to try, that idiot's going to try to find, the idiot being me, he's going to find a way to be successful off tackle.
Well, I think that is great advice. I just need somebody to say that because I think that's great advice for everybody, to tell you the truth, John, because you gotta be known for something. And your kids gotta have that. The kids gotta know. We're gonna do this come hell or high water. You know, and once you get the kids believing us.
When we get out there, especially the line, we'll say, Coach, let's just run 56, or Coach, let's just run 65. That's all they'll say.
Mm-hmm.
By what we do in practice, they know, look, this is, if we can't run 56 and 65, there's a good chance we may not be successful that night unless we come up with some big trick to do it.
Mm-hmm. And you don't want to do that too many times, come up with tricks to do something.
That's right.
Well, John, this concludes all the questions I have. Do you have any final things you want to say?
No. I've probably divulged way too much about John Ward already tonight.
No, you've done good. No, and I really appreciate you coming on. You know, I have been sitting here scared as hell because this is the first time I've ever done anything like this. But I see a need for us to do this and to bring some of the guys who've been doing it for a while on so that we can talk, not necessarily about X's and O's, but about philosophies and how we do things and everything. And I want to thank you for being on tonight, John. And,
thank you.
And we're going to have you back on again, and maybe next time we'll get into some more things.
You bet.
Okay, John, have a good night. I'll talk at you later, okay?
You bet. Bye-bye.
Okay, bye-bye. Okay, bye-bye. All right, guys, that's complete our show for tonight. Next week's show is going to be great. We got Harold Strauss. And let me say this before we get going here. I want to thank John for coming on. John is he's a master at this because he gives so much information. And if you don't get the information, gosh, you are missing. I hope you had your pencil taking notes and everything, because I was. Next week on the Triple Wing Hammer Report, we got Harold Strauss, formerly of Colton High School in California. Now he's at Grand Terrace High School trying to build another program out there. And Harold's going to join us next week. And he is the epitome of the triple wing because when you look at his tapes, he has combined single, double, and wing T concept into his offense. And he, you know, you look at his tapes and everything. His guys were rolling. I mean, he has done a good job, and he almost has this other school, Grand Terrence High School, just about there. So, this is Leonard, and I want you to I want to thank you for being here tonight, and I want you to have a good day and coming week. And if you got any comments, you can always email me. Any questions, you can always email me. And if you got any ideas of people that we can bring on, and if you got any ways that we can do this better, let me know. I mean, we just want to serve you. So I want everybody to have a good night, and thank you for tuning in. And as Louis Armstrong said, have a great day.
I see skies of blue and clouds.
Good night, all.
The bright, blessed day, the dark, sacred night. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world. The colors of the rainbow, so pretty in the sky, are also on the faces of people going by. I see friends shaking hands, saying how do you do. They're really saying I love you. I hear babies cry, I watch them grow. They're like much more than I never knew. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world. Yes, I think to myself, what a wonderful world.
Have a great night, everybody, and a great week.